Data Points podcast, where we discuss all things government and data. I'm your co-host, Sharon Paley.
And I'm Eric Reese. This week, we're talking with Lee Tammy, the City of Cincinnati's Chief Performance Officer. So Lee, in her role as Chief Performance Officer for Cincinnati, is responsible for leading their Office of Performance and Data Analytics, which includes their program Cincy Insights and Results Cincy.
So we're going to be talking to Lee about her work in Cincinnati, how she got started with the city. We're going to do a special focus on the city's opioid tracker and try to understand how it can be adopted by other cities and how it's making critical changes for the people of Cincinnati. So let's go to the interview with Lee to learn more.
Lee, thanks so much for joining us today. Can you tell us, how did you get started in the world of government data?
Yeah, so definitely not because of my background. So I have actually, I have an undergraduate degree in theology and a JD, so I went to law school. So really, like, nothing in my background indicates that I could or should be doing data work. But when I was in law school, I realized that I really enjoyed the way that we were being taught analysis and analytical thinking. A lot of the reasoning that you learn in law school is understanding conditions and categories and what conditions facilitate which categories. You look a lot at rules and exceptions and then exceptions to those exceptions, and you have to think a lot about when the rules change, how the exceptions also change, and then how those change when they're applied to fact patterns. So I really enjoyed that aspect of law school, but I didn't really want to practice law, which I realized probably... Well, I realized it pretty quickly. So the summer after my second year of law school, I started working for a nonprofit on the financial model for a universal preschool initiative. And once I started looking at financial impact based on, the type of tax that you look at, how constituents are affected by different using different tax pools, what the cost is based on subsidy level and application, I started really understanding the way that analytical thinking can apply to things like government finance, public finance, that kind of thing. So really what I started digging into without even realizing it was data. So after I did that work for a little while after I graduated from law school and took the bar, and then I actually came to work in this current office, in our Office of Performance and Data Analytics, because I was recruited by my predecessor. So once I got here, I sort of realized pretty quickly that I'd accidentally stumbled into a lot of things that I really love, which is dealing with people, digging stuff out of obscure places, so a lot of data discovery, creative problem solving, and I really enjoyed the fact that working at the local government level, it's pretty easy to affect actual change. You can affect it pretty quickly, particularly when you're in data, and that change has implications for things that affect everyday life, like when the trash is picked up or when potholes are filled, things like that.
Yeah, that's a great story and path. And I think, as Sharon said, we have heard all kinds of weird and interesting paths into local government, and they're all awesome. So thank you for sharing that background, because I think it's really critical to your perspective on how projects are working in Cincinnati and your work with data. And I'm curious, what's been kind of the most interesting project that you've worked on in your time in Cincinnati?
So I'd say definitely launching Cincy Insights, which is our open data dashboard portal. So when I was pretty new to my role, probably just a couple months in, I was looking at how we were using data in the city, which at that point was primarily for like performance management. And I realized a couple things. So the first was that we didn't really need to collect data for stat or for really anything just via like Excel spreadsheets, which I think is a pretty typical model or a pretty traditional way that a lot of performance management programs capture things. You look at KPIs, they're manually reported, and you sort of go from there in terms of looking at performance. So I realized, you know, we really didn't need to be doing this. We could just hook up to all these departments' data sources. So once I realized that, it was sort of a game changer. Simultaneously, I realized that, and I say this as a person who didn't come from a data background, that open data still wasn't really accessible to a lot of people. And that's particularly true in a city like Cincinnati that doesn't historically have a huge civic tech population. So I think in a lot of other cities, there are a lot of people who either have experience with open data or have been using it or it's been around for a long time. We just really don't have that very much here. So open data was, for the most part, not totally constructively accessible to a lot of people. So once we started pulling in raw data from all these data sources around the city, pretty much the first thing we realized was how much we needed to like clean and transform that data, right? So because we were trying to use it, because we wanted to use it to map things or visualize things or understand things in more or less real time. So this was really cool because we actually ended up building out our internal analytics infrastructure. We have a pretty robust ETL process for pulling in data from all over the city in terms of data sources. We pull from a lot of vendors as well. We do a lot of cleaning, then we centrally warehouse it and push it into views in our data warehouse. So ultimately, again, we kind of built out this infrastructure really because we needed it. We had to have a standard way of looking at and cleaning all this data that was coming in. So the external result was Cincy Insights, which is our open data dashboard portal. From the beginning of creating that, the back end infrastructure to the end result being initially published was like 6 or 7 months. So it was really fast. That's a project that I would tell most people is like a 2-year endeavor. But I think that sort of the process behind it is really important for a couple of reasons. Number one, we were making sure that we ended up doing something that wasn't just useful for public consumption of data. A lot of our departments started being able to really understand their data and use it and see it visualized. But I think that was also like the fun part, right? Using data across the enterprise and creating standards for how we're looking at it, how we're geocoding it, the way that we're seeing it. The front result was really great. I was really proud that we were able to turn data into information and create these interactive visualizations. But the really cool part, the really fun part, was creating this system behind it. So I'd say that was like the most interesting, or at least the most heaviest lift, I guess, in terms of things that we've done since I've been here.
How did you create like the groundswell to get that process moving so fast? I mean, we hear a lot when we're working with other cities about the struggle to open up those kind of pipes, if you will. So how were you guys able to operate so quickly?
Yeah, so I think there's really like two primary reasons. The first is we had a lot of executive buy-in. So our office was created by the city manager here, and essentially whenever we wanted access to data, he made sure that departments didn't really have a choice in terms of saying yes or no, that if we wanted access, we had access. So going in knowing that we had that kind of buy-in was really important. I'd say honestly the second reason that we were able to do this is that we did it very quickly and no one totally understood what we were doing until it was done. Which sounds maybe, like we weren't being coy, we weren't trying to, obscure it per se, but I think moving quickly definitely was an advantage in this. We kind of were hooking up to all these databases, pulling all this data in, cleaning it, and as soon as we realized the use case and sort of created these dashboards, we like put them out there. And at that point, nobody wants to be the person who turns off the heroin overdose response tracker. No one wants to be the person who turns off the snowplow tracker. So I think putting those prototypes out there as quickly as we could and getting not just public buy-in, but also executive buy-in, really, frankly, operational buy-in was key to the success of this initiative.
Yeah, and Lee, you mentioned one thing there that I know we planned to talk about, and I think this is a good time, is the heroin overdose tracker and the opioid tracker that you all developed. I think that's one of the most interesting use cases. Can you talk a little bit about how you got to the point of launching that and why, and really what the results have been, now that it's out there?
Yeah, definitely. So it's funny, whenever I talk to cities or organizations about using their data, I always tell them to like start with a real problem, just to bite something off and run with it. So really when I was like a month into my position, it was in August 2016, I was actually at a conference in Chicago with our EMS chief, and that was when Cincinnati started seeing a huge spike in heroin overdoses. So I think between August 20th and 26th in 2016, we had 174 overdoses. So that's like more than one every hour, which is a lot. And when we were there, our EMS chief started immediately, we all started getting these text messages or calls kind of about what was going on. It was blowing up national news. and our EMS chief started immediately talking about the workload on paramedics. They were really concerned about how that we were going to have to start deploying roving medics, which paramedic units were getting the most activity, which because I knew at that point but hadn't thought about the implications. Paramedics are really only supposed to do between 8 and 12 runs per 24-hour shift. 8 is to keep their skills sharp, and 12 is the top in terms of avoiding burnout. And ours were averaging like 16. So that's a lot. And in addition to, burning out paramedics, which you don't want to burn people out, of course, that's like a two-year investment. And, of course, then that's fewer people that's going to increase the workload on everyone else if you have fewer resources. So, you know, they were kind of talking about this and about how we were going to have to deploy our resources. And in the middle of this, at the Stata conference, I realized, first of all, that despite being the data office and, like, the data person, I didn't know anything about what was going on. I had no clue, like, where these things were happening or what time, or I just had, like, no idea. And then I think listening to them talk, I realized, you know, probably the best way that I could wrap my own head around this was to start looking at our dispatch. So looking at, how first responders were dispatched in response to heroin overdoses. So thinking about this, I called my then analyst and said, hey, you know, I know we're pulling in this CAD data, computer-aided dispatch data. We need to start tracking this. We need to start mapping it. So that was the inception of the heroin overdose tracker, which frankly was sort of how we started thinking about and realizing the value of having open data visualized through dashboards. So, our heroin overdose tracker uses computer-aided dispatch data to show responses to overdoses. So it's broken out by month, day, year, hour of the day of the week, volume per day, neighborhood, and it's searchable by street. The other component of this that we have is medic transport outcome, which is like disposition. So this is really important because it tells you whether the response resulted in a medic transport, so like a transportation to a hospital, which is probably the best proxy that we have for looking at whether people are, you know, interfacing with a healthcare network or healthcare system and are able to potentially access treatment. So what we started noticing was that we had higher, you know, it's, so now when we look at this, we can notice when we have a higher number of people who are being transported, when we have a high number of people who aren't. That also gives us an idea of how much heroin use is actually happening in our community that we are not seeing if all we're documenting is like hospital visits. So all of this data is, it goes historically back to 2015, and we use Tableau Public. It's fully interactive. So if you want to drill into, you know, month, you can click on a month. Everything else filters against it. If you want to look at a month and a neighborhood within that month, you click on neighborhood. You can pick as many filters as you want to drill down into kind of what's happening. We anonymize all of the incident data. We don't want to, like, drop a pin on someone's house, right? So we get rid of the street number, and we skew the latitude and longitude. So again, we are anonymizing it, but we're trying to make it as granular as possible so that we can really kind of see what's going on. So why is it, you know, I guess for us, the question that I think about a lot is like, why does it matter? Why is it important? So first of all, it shows us when and where and how to deploy our resources. So when we created it, we were really thinking about how do we make sure that we know where and when to send our roving medics, our first responders. So it's been really key for that, particularly when we have spikes, because it helps us think through how we deploy what in every city is a limited resource, which is paramedics. I think the second reason it's been really helpful is it's a pretty good proxy as far as like a building a model for heroin or opioid use in this community. I always have to remind people, I have to tell people, look, this does not capture all heroin use. This doesn't capture even all heroin overdoses. This doesn't capture individual user activity. It doesn't tell you, you know, repeat people or repeat, you know, when people, we had to go back or if someone, at what point someone went into treatment, because we're not looking at individual health data. That was kind of on purpose. I didn't want to run up against HIPAA. So we're using dispatch data. It's just dispatch activity. So it's a pretty, despite that, it's a pretty accurate way of kind of assessing when and where use is happening, when we see spikes in overdoses, that tells us that more likely than not, we have like a batch of carfentanil that's coming through the area, which was what was behind our major spike in August of 2016. And it also allows us to see seasonal or monthly or even weekly patterns. So we've used it a lot internally, but we've also discovered that a lot of other organizations are using it as well. There's an NGO here called Talbert House, and they use the heroin overdose response tracker to target particular areas in the community for like civilian Narcan training. So it's a little bleak, but it's something that has become really important here to reduce the number of deaths from overdoses. So when they see that there's a spike in overdoses in a particular community or a particular area, they will target that area for like Narcan disbursement and use training. We've also had a number of NGOs, and including our health department, which is part of our city departments, come to us and tell us that they've used this for targeting prevention or outreach. In fact, one woman who currently works in our health department received a grant to do education for kids about, you know, heroin use, drug use, and, you know, how to kind of starting that conversation at a younger age. So she picked one of the communities where there were a high volume of overdoses, and then it turned out when she started doing this work, like almost all the kids in the room, I mean, these are like 8 to 10-year-olds, almost all of them had been personally affected by either overdose, related deaths, heroin use, or some kind of substance abuse, drug use in their families. So we've seen a lot of other organizations use that, but I think what we're also starting to see, in fact, just this week, someone started like tweeting this at me. We now are seeing that by looking at our blueprint and seeing what business rules are kind of built into our visualization, other civic tech groups are able to use this data for other purposes. So they're able to use it for, you know, analysis of, in terms of like putting out resources, treatment. We've started having like a syringe needle exchange as a result of sort of seeing where this is happening. So I think there's a lot of, it shows that there's a lot of potential uses for this data. And also this is data that all local governments and municipalities are sitting on. I tell cities this all the time. This is scalable and replicable because if you have a police department, if you have a fire department, you have CAD. If you have CAD, that means you're capturing basically this information and you can start tracking this exactly the same way that we are.
So what do you think is like the biggest challenge for cities working with data going forward? Kind of talked about what the challenges are currently, but like looking ahead.
Yeah. So I think in my view, a lot of cities need to start really thinking about data as the product of systems that need to be maintained and integrated just like any other government assets. So right now, I think in the realm of like civic data or even civic tech, there's a lot of emphasis on how we clean data, how we normalize it. We really like investing in and talking about data science, but we're really not talking very much about data architecture and systems integration. And those are really crucial things that we kind of need to start finding a way to talk about more, because if you are producing clean or usable data at the point of data entry, you're going to save yourself a lot of time and trouble on the other side when you're trying to figure out, for example, all the activity that's happening on like Vine Street. I think street and address data is like a really good example of this. One of the reasons it's so hard to figure out city data in any city is because address data is almost never standardized. And that's something that if you integrated systems or thought about how to structure data that's coming in through your different systems, these are things like field or address validation or mandatory fields or automating data entry or tying it to business products, like, or business processes. I mean, if more cities thought about data this way, I think that it would definitely save a lot of time and energy on the other side.
Yeah, and can you start, I think, for cities to do that? What is the key thing? I know you talked about starting with a problem. How can cities really get going to start that and eventually connect that to better results for residents at the end of the day?
So I think there's like a few things, right? The first is most cities have no idea how much data they actually have, really because they haven't thought about how they want to use it. Most cities have police and fire departments, which means they have CAD data. most of them, as they've bought fleet in the past few years, they have some kind of like asset or fleet tracking data. If they have permits or customer service requests or some kind of like workflow data, there's a lot of stuff that you can dig out of that data if you start getting your hands dirty. I think this also sort of speaks to this view that data is like this mysterious, mystical thing. It sort of is put in that black box of technology. And I think that's something that, you know, in civic data and civic tech, really just in general, we need to start breaking down. Data really exists because something happened. There was some event, some activity, some transaction. Sometimes there was an asset. And there were certain things that we wanted to know about it. That's what a row of data is. And I think if more people understood that, particularly, you know, people who make decisions in city government, it would become less scary. They would be less afraid of sort of digging in and using it and seeing what's there. I think sort of going along with that, something I've seen a lot in cities is that cities are finding it difficult to attract people who want to like do this work. And that's a whole separate conversation, but I think that a lot of cities would benefit a lot from sort of rethinking some of their hiring or HR models. You know, for a lot of this work, it's really intensive and it's a heavy lift, and people are going to be coming in and then leaving after, you know, 2 or 3 years, which is not really like the traditional city or government employee model. But I think that if cities start adjusting their hiring and recruiting practices to accommodate that, they're going to get really great people who are excited about this work, and there's going to just be a lot more productivity and progress overall.
I think there's a way in which to demystify data for, you're talking about it sort of more at the leadership management level, but also for frontline programmatic folks that work in cities. How do you recommend getting that done?
Yeah, so I think what I tell all of my analysts when I send them out into the field with departments is, you know, despite being the performance and data analytics office, we don't start with the performance part. The first thing that we do is create a tool or some kind of like visualization for frontline workers so that they see the value in what we do. I think a lot of them, at least like traditionally, you know what data they input, but they don't really think, they haven't just been given the skills or been, you know, no one's bothered sort of talking through this is what we're using this for overall. But if you can use data to enhance efficiency and make their lives easier, I think then there's like an intrinsic understanding in terms of, you know, this is what you're putting in, this is what's coming out, and this is what it tells you about what you're doing. I think for us, a big example of that is looking at our vehicle trackers. So our snowplow tracker, for example, we initially kind of had some pushback on it, but then once we started putting it out publicly, we were able to show not just where the vehicles weren't, but where they were during a snowstorm. All of a sudden, our operations people really bought in because they felt like, yeah, this really captures the work that I am doing. I'm actually kind of getting credit for things that happened. And they were able to see, you know, oh, these two trucks went on these two streets that were a block away from each other within an hour. Maybe we should like optimize these routes.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today, Lee. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Thanks again to Lee for joining us today. For more information on her work in Cincinnati, go to cincinnati-oh.gov. You can find show notes and other GovX resources on our website at govx.jhu.edu and learn more about the work we're doing by following us on Twitter and Instagram at gov_ex.
If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a review on iTunes or Google Play or wherever you're consuming this podcast. Your support for us means a lot, and it really helps us get ourselves up in the rankings, which is critically important with podcasting. Thanks again, and we look forward to joining you next time to find out where the data points.